Have you ever had a wake-up call? I can remember a Trinity Lutheran Church trip a few years back. We had just arrived in Israel. We found ourselves in a beautiful hotel on the Mediterranean coast. We got our rooms. We came together to enjoy the first of many dinners together. The food in Israel is wonderful, fresh, tasty. Some had a glass of wine, and everyone enjoyed a dessert, and then another, and then another. And then we put our jet-lagged pilgrims to bed. I said, sleep well. We have a wake-up call scheduled for 6:30 in the morning. We will have an Israeli breakfast, and then we'll set off in the footsteps of Jesus. I went up, and I slept like a rock for 90 minutes. And then I was awake, staring at the ceiling. You see, it was mid-afternoon, Seattle. My body did not know what time it was. I was awake. I was showered and ready to go out for a walk by 5:30 a.m. The coast of the Mediterranean was magnificent. The colors of the sunrise gave me great hope for the pilgrimage that was about to begin. Returning to my room at 6:15, I quickly pulled out my Bible and reviewed the sights that we were going to see that morning. 6:30, no wake-up call. 6:35, no wake-up call. 6:37, no wake-up call. I was out of my room. I was headed for the front desk. I happened upon one of our travelers in the hall. I said, did you get a wake-up call? They said, no, we just couldn't sleep. I said, I'll see you at breakfast. I went down to the front desk, and there I found a sleepy-eyed Israeli who looked more jet-lagged than I did. He said, sorry, we forgot to program the wake-up call. I was not amused. I said, this needs to be done right now. And so he handed me a sheet of paper with room numbers on it. He said, you will need this. I said, I'm going to need it. Why will I need it? He said, well, if you want to call the right rooms, you're going to need this. I said, you call them. He said, I don't have the time. Because he was doing nothing, I might add. Well, I didn't have time to argue with him. So I ran off, running down the halls, knocking on the doors of all of our pilgrims. They were almost all awake anyway. It was the first day of our pilgrimage, and I am reasonably sure that it was the last day that that night clerk ever worked at that hotel. The good news is no one missed breakfast, no one missed the bus, it all turned out fine. Have you ever had a wake-up call? In the wee hours of the morning last Monday, I had a dream. You see, the night before, Felicia and I were watching a segment on 60 Minutes. And in that segment, there was a man on there who lost his job because of an illness. So this must have been like in my head somewhere. So I dreamed that quite suddenly, I'd lost my job. My office door was locked and all my stuff was sitting outside. I had lost my job. I was elated. No, wait a minute. No, I was sad. I remember the terror of not knowing like what I was going to do now. How I was going to survive, what would happen to my family. I woke up from the dream, I took a shower, came to work, I was happy to see the locks had not been changed. Wake up calls. One of my closest friends, a classmate from Luther Seminary, called me a few weeks back, early on a Thursday morning. Pastor Deb is a trusted colleague, travel companion, a fantastic pastor who has served for the past 18 years at Anacortes. She followed Pastor Dennis in at Anacortes Lutheran Church. The phone rang at 6:15 a.m. She said, are you in the office? I said, yes. She said, can I come see you? I said, of course. What's going on? She said, I'm leaving my congregation, and I'm dying. Pastor Deb, younger than me, and her ELCA pastor husband were in my office soon after that. We sat here around this baptismal font. We cried and prayed. We touched the baptismal waters and claimed God's promises in the face of death. We called out for resurrection. Pastor Deb met with doctors at Virginia Mason, got a second opinion at the Mayo Clinic. She speaks very freely of her journey and her prognosis on her Caring Bridge page. The prognosis is grim. She ended her post this past Tuesday by saying, I am home from cancer camp and ready to move forward and get living. Thanks be to God for every day, month, and year that I have to live. She would tell us now that every day seems different to her. Every hug is now sweeter. Every prayer is from the heart. Every tender moment with family is recognized for what it is. And every breath of air that fills your lungs is noticed. And every moment now is a gift. And the plans and the worries that accompanied her just a few weeks ago are no longer of any consequence. Her life will be shorter than she planned. Her life will end as ours will end. Have you ever had a wake-up call? A moment of clarity? When you realize that the wake-up call at that hotel in Israel probably didn't make a difference in the course of human history? A moment of clarity when you realize that you were focusing on things that were really of little importance? A moment of clarity when tragedy or beauty or grace interrupted your daily routine and reminded you of something deeper, more meaningful, more eternal? You know, it was 1 year ago yesterday that the Washington Huskies played football at Husky Stadium. And you remember what happened? No, no one remembers what happened. Wake-up calls. They simply offer us the opportunity to awake from slumber and to greet a new day, to see with new eyes, to come to some understanding of what is really important. Opportunities can be seized or they can be ignored. Wake-up calls can rouse us to a new day, or we can hit the snooze button and snooze right through life. Now, in our lesson today, Jesus, the master storyteller, shares a parable with all who would listen. It is called the parable of the unjust steward. It follows immediately behind the parable of the prodigal son that we talked about last week. It's found in the 16th chapter of the Gospel of Luke, and it's been referred to as the hardest parable of Jesus. The hardest parable, meaning the most difficult to understand, the hardest to comprehend exactly what Jesus is saying. The parable has confounded theologians for 2,000 years. So I will take a run at it this morning. Jesus pulls us in close and says, "Folks, I have a story for you. There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought against him that this man had squandered his property. So he summoned him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Give me an accounting of your management, for you cannot be my manager any longer.' Then the manager said to himself, 'What will I do now? Now that my master has taken my position away from me, I am not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do so that when I am dismissed as manager, people may welcome me into their homes.' So he summoned his master's debtors one by one. He asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' And he answered, 100 jugs of olive oil.' 'Very good,' said the manager. 'Take your bill. Sit down quickly and make it 50, and I will sign it.' Then he asked another, 'And how much do you owe?' He replied, 100 containers of wheat. He said, 'Sit down. Sit down quickly. Take your bill. Make it 80. And his master, when he found out what he had done, commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. And then Jesus continued saying, 'For the children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than that of the children of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth.'" The words of Jesus, the gospel of the Lord. Come on, say it like you mean it. What? A complacent manager is fired? A dishonest manager is praised, lifted up in the community? Make friends by means of dishonest wealth? What is Jesus up to? Let's start with the context. It's late. It's late in the story. It's late in the Gospel of Luke. It's late in Jesus' 3 years of ministry. Jesus is about to face the cross. That means the lives of the disciples are about to be shattered, and it's all going to happen, and it's going to happen very suddenly. From a joyful Passover celebration on Thursday night to a cross on Friday, this wake-up call for the disciples is just around the corner. That's the context. In the story, we encounter the manager. Now, everyone here this morning is a manager of one kind or another. Some manage households, some manage businesses, some manage children, some manage grandchildren. Some manage their own finances while others manage the wealth of those around them. And as we look at this text, we have no reason to believe that the manager in this story was anything but competent. It seems to me that his problem was not incompetence at all, but rather complacency or apathy. The proof of this comes from the details of the parable. The rich man trusted his manager to oversee his business affairs. No doubt he expected the manager to work very hard, to be resourceful, to be creative, and to be faithful. But what he discovered instead was that the manager was not being responsible. His accounts were not being tended to, and in fact, his possessions were being wasted. So the rich man called the manager into his office. The manager pulled up in his blue BMW, parked in his reserved spot, and it was then that the unsuspecting manager received a wake-up call. He was taken to task. He was given the opportunity to defend himself, to explain his less than inspired performance. But he could not. He could not explain, and he was fired. You have until tomorrow morning to clean out your desk and get out of my sight. Move on. What to do now? He drove away and he was in a panic. You see, he was not strong enough to dig ditches. It was too late to go to law school. He could not afford medical school. And there were no calls available in the local Lutheran churches. The rich man had his attention. The adrenaline was now running through every fiber of his body. The manager was wide awake, no apathy, no complacency. And so what did he do? He got to work. He worked like his life depended on it because it did. He visited every client in a single day. And keep in mind, some of them he had not seen in years. He was suddenly creative. He was shrewd. He was motivated. He made deals. He bought friends. He stored up lots of goodwill. The debtors who had dreaded a visit from him now popped champagne corks and drank with him. And the next day, his boss, the rich man, looked at what he had done, all that he had accomplished in a single day, and he said, "I knew you had it in you. I knew I didn't make a mistake when I hired you years ago. I knew that you were capable. I knew you could do this job. You just lost your motivation. You lost your focus. You lost your drive. You forgot what you were supposed to be doing. You needed a wake-up call, and I gave it to you." And Jesus praises the dishonest steward. When couples are getting married, I have them place in a sealed envelope a listing of five things or more that they did together, enjoyed doing together as they were falling in love. The bride and the groom do it separately. Then we take their sealed envelopes, put it in a larger envelope with the instructions to take it out and read it to each other for the first time on their first wedding anniversary. On the sealed envelope, then, there's a place for their initials from that year and for every year following for the next 10. I tell them that what they have is a written recipe, the recipe that they followed when they were falling in love. I know from my pastoral counseling experience that when couples come to me in trouble after 7 or 10 or 20 years, that they have mostly lost their focus. So I have them do this same exercise and grade themselves on how they have been doing in each of those areas over the last year or two. And the scores are pathetic. They are predictably low. What happened? Inevitably, they just quit. They did not quit on the marriage. They did not quit on each other. No, they just quit. They quit having date nights. They quit talking about their hopes and dreams together. They quit taking days off from work just to play with each other at the beach or in the city. You see, there was no ill intent or desire to grow apart. It happens. It just happens when work and children and aging parents and life demand all of your time and energy. And if there is no wake-up call, the love promised on that wedding day can simply fade away. This yearly exercise is meant to be a wake-up call for them. Now, in our life together, we live almost every day with life and death. And I'm amazed how quickly life can change, your life and mine. Those who are here and healthy one Sunday morning are suddenly not healthy. They're suddenly no longer with us, and their pew is missing. Their assigned place is empty. This morning, we have been given a wake-up call. So I'd encourage you to wake up. Do not take your loved ones for granted. Do not become complacent. Do not be lulled into a false sense of security. Do not wait to speak words of love and thankfulness. Do not wait until it's too late. Be creative. Be resourceful. Be thankful. This is a wake-up call, so speak the words that you need to speak and mend fences and offer forgiveness and seek forgiveness and send flowers and walk on the beach and take time to smell the roses. Pastor Deb said, "I'm leaving my congregation and I'm dying. I'm home from cancer camp and ready to move forward and get living. Thanks be to God for every day, month, and year I have yet to live." My friends, live with intention. Be intentional. Trust in the amazing grace of God and love. To do anything else would be to have missed this wake-up call.